with Jason Jones, Esquire. Jason is a lawyer in San Diego, California. Jason has a very interesting background. He started out at the University of California, San Diego, studying biology with a minor in psychology. And then he went into the working world. And what I like about Jason is not only is he a lawyer, but he has experience in the real world. He worked in the dot-com and the Internet field for a while, and then went to law school, graduated magna cum laude from Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. And he actually was awarded the 2006 Medal of Excellence from the American Bankruptcy Institute. He is a bankruptcy specialist. And I appreciate your being able to visit with us, Jason.
No problem. Just one quick correction. In order to be a bankruptcy specialist, we have to be certified as a specialist, which requires a whole bunch of hoops to jump through. And I'm technically not a bankruptcy specialist. I do bankruptcy as my only area of practice, but that the term specialist is reserved for people who have a particular certification, mm-hmm. which I do not have.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Well, we're on the subject of corrections and things like that. You also wanted to make sure that our listeners got a disclaimer so that they understand that you're not offering legal advice.
Sure, right. Yeah, this recording is not intended to be legal advice. It's also not intended to be an interpretation of the law. It should be used primarily to identify issues that are important to you that you can use in your discussions with your own attorney.
Now, if people wanted to reach you after this, they've listened, how would they reach you?
They could give our office a call. I'm happy to talk to anybody. The phone number at the office would be 858-793-9800. Alternately, they could find our website, www.avatarlegal.com. That's A, V as in Victor, A, T as in Tom, A, R as in Roger, legal.com.
Okay, well, good. Jason, who calls you typically to discuss filing bankruptcy? What kind of people do you hear from?
You know, I really get everybody. I get individuals who are, you know, straight out of undergrad, you know, with large credit card debt that they've picked up through all of the heavy credit card pushing that happens in colleges these days. I get people who are working part-time jobs and are at the lower end of the economic scale. But I also get people who are highly educated and typically well-off, who have had some particular instance that has happened in their life in the last 6 months to a year that's knocked them off of their sound financial footing. Either a business that they started has failed, or they've had a car accident and have had $100,000 in surgeries, or any number of things can knock somebody off of sound footing. That happens typically because what I've found is that most Americans these days are working on a paycheck to paycheck kind of basis, and they tend to spend, with the encouragement of the credit industry, up to their level of income, meaning there's not a lot of saving going on. Most people in the last 10 years, I've found, and I'm not talking from looking at any particular statistics, but rather just general sense of things, most people have their largest source of equity has been in their home as home values have risen up. And unfortunately, in the last couple of years, the mortgage industry has been pushing individuals to borrow against that equity. And with these dangerous high interest loans, they'll pick up, 100% loan on their property that was a large equity cushion. But now they've got a mortgage that they can afford, but it's a teaser rate and it's going to be adjusting up in about 2 years. A lot of that lending happened 2 years ago, and we're starting to see those adjustable rates kicking up and people falling off of their ability to pay it, even though they were formerly able to.
So you've got the people calling you. There's some people that just happen to have a hardship that came up in their life, such as a really severe medical problem or unexpected a long period of unemployment. But then you've also got people who have gotten involved in a mortgage that's resetting to a much higher rate, and they can't afford that payment, and they thought that they would be able to refinance, but they can't. Is that accurate?
That's true, and that's happening a lot more these days. A couple years back, that was a smaller percentage of bankruptcy individuals, but now we're starting to see foreclosures being a real big problem, and people are starting to, in an effort to save their houses, stop paying credit cards or incurring other debts during the period when they're finding themselves barely able to afford their house. And then when they're finally at the point where they can no longer afford their house and they can't pull out any more credit, they're staring down the barrel of foreclosure, and they have, $50,000-$60,000 of unsecured debt on top of it, and they're not sure what to do.
Well, I'd like to find out what someone's options are that you would suggest if they don't want to be seeing you.
Right. Well, the first thing, I would encourage anybody, of course, to speak with somebody who understands the options and explain their particular circumstance, because while there are a number of general rules, there's also some very significant exceptions to things that can reverse any piece of advice. But generally, the kinds of options that people have when facing a foreclosure, that's your question?
Yes. What are the options, and how would someone avoid making a trip to the bankruptcy lawyer?
Right. Their options generally are, obviously, number one, at one extreme, pay for the mortgage, but they're not able to do that. The second is attempt to refinance to get a better loan that has a fixed rate, and your rate would hopefully drop. Most of the time, I'm finding that the people who are speaking to me don't have that option because they've already refinanced and there's just not a lot of equity left anymore, especially in a declining real estate market. A third option is to attempt what's called a short sale and try to sell the house for its current fair market value, even though that's less than the total amount of liability on the house, the total amount of the mortgages. And to do that, you need approval by the bank. And so that process takes time, and you would need to begin that process early on in the foreclosure process. Occasionally, banks will accept a deed in lieu, which is a deed in lieu of foreclosure, which basically means that instead of going through the foreclosure process, you can just hand the property back to the bank. There are complications with deeds in lieu, and it takes a little while, and I rarely see that successful in my practice, but it does happen.
Well, let's say that a theoretical person, and again, we're not being specific because that's impossible. Let's say this theoretical person owes a bunch of money on credit cards. I don't know, $30,000-$40,000 worth. They have a mortgage, and perhaps they can't pay the new adjustable rate that's coming up. What should this type of typical person do? I mean, should they stop paying on their credit cards and then make the mortgage payment, or should they stop making the mortgage payment and keep the credit cards up? Let's assume that they can't pay everything. What would be something that they would often, that you would suggest to that type of person?
Well, it would depend on their priorities and their financial situation, and we're trying to be general here, but it's actually impossible because there are specifics that are required to answer that question. For instance, if it's a home that they can't afford but for their extensive monthly payments on their credit card bills. So let's make up numbers. So they've got a $2,000 a month mortgage, but they're paying $1,000 a month in credit card bills. Maybe their mortgage is just adjusted up to $2,700. They were able to barely make the original $2,000 mortgage plus $1,000 credit card payments. But now they can't make a $2,700 mortgage and a $1,000 credit card payment. So what do they do? Well, in that case, I would talk to the individual and we would discuss actually the option of bankruptcy. Because in bankruptcy, what we would be able to do is get rid of that credit card debt, which means you wouldn't have the $1,000 a month of payments to make, but you could still make the $2,700 payment because you've got $3,000 total, $2,700 goes to the mortgage now, and nothing goes to credit cards. If instead their mortgage had adjusted upwards, or they lost a job, or a family member lost a job, and there was no longer the revenue stream that allows them to make the $2,000 mortgage payment, period, we might consider just talking about alternatives to, or what really not alternatives, but what the real results of foreclosure are. And it may make sense, frankly, for somebody to walk away from the house. People get very attached to the concept of being a homeowner, especially individuals who have just bought for the first time. And they don't want to lose the home, especially if they've got small children. But it may make the most financial sense for those individuals to walk away from their home, especially if that home is oversecured. In other words, it's a $250,000 home with $300,000 of loans on it, because, you know, you got those loans 2 years ago when the house was worth 3.25.
Right. It doesn't make sense, in other words, for some people to continue paying on a house if they owe more than it's worth and they can't afford to live there anymore.
If they can't afford to live there, then yes, it may not make sense for them to do that. In which case, I might suggest, well, let's try to ease through the... And this is where we would, if they came to me early enough or talked to somebody who knew how to do a short sale, we might talk about the short sale option to try to avoid the bankruptcy altogether, or avoid the foreclosure. But in a worst-case scenario, they would be staring at a foreclosure, and they should continue to pay on their credit cards to avoid having to declare bankruptcy on them.
So if somebody has owes credit cards and a loan on their house, it's not necessarily true that they should just pay the house and then not pay the credit cards. What are the ramifications if that is the case? If somebody does that, let's just say, you know, they say, well, I need my house, but I don't need my credit card, so I'll just stop paying on the credit cards.
Right. And people, just as an aside, people make either that decision or the opposite decision when it comes time to having to make the decision. They either say, I'm going to pay for the house because I need the house and I don't need the cards. Or they'll say, well, I'll stop paying on the house, but I need the credit cards because that's how I'm paying for groceries and that's how I'm paying for gas and that's how I'm paying for the utilities. They're not going to take my house next month, but they will turn my credit cards off. So people make, you know, one decision or the other. But the question was,
how does somebody determine, you know, how to make that decision if it is credit cards or house payment? How do you decide which?
And that's where we go back to, they look at their own personal situation as to whether or not keeping the house is something that they feel like they need to do or in fact can do. And if you need to keep the house and you can keep the house, then you need to keep the payments up on the house. And there are tools like bankruptcy or settling that debt out that can allow you to back off of those credit cards, either walk away from them entirely or, you know, have a smaller amount to pay on them. So it's going to depend on whether or not you can actually make the payments on the house. The effect of, which I believe was the earlier question, of not paying on the credit cards is essentially you're going to start having those credit cards. The credit cards will close out the accounts. They'll shut them down so that you can no longer use them. They will begin, often interest rates will shift from a normal interest rate of something like, you know, 12-20%, and they'll shift to a penalty interest rate that's more in the mid to high 30s. You'll see credit card fees. So the balances will start shooting up rapidly. And in addition, you're going to start seeing credit hits. You'll get lates on your credit report and that kind of thing. However, those penalties may be minor if we're staring down the barrel of a bankruptcy regardless. And a bankruptcy can wipe out those credit card debts pretty much regardless of how much debt is on them, as long as you didn't do certain things like charge up the cards in contemplation of bankruptcy or things like that.
So the bankruptcy can deal with the credit cards, and so if somebody stops paying on their credit cards and they feel that that's they're going to end up they just can't handle it, bankruptcy can do that. But can a bankruptcy help somebody who can't make those house payments? How does a bankruptcy help somebody in foreclosure, or does it?
It helps certain individuals who are under threat of foreclosure, and it doesn't help everybody. You need, in order to be able to keep your house in a bankruptcy, either in a Chapter 7 or a 13, you need to be able to make the baseline house payments. And by baseline, I mean even after the rate has adjusted up on you and now it's $2,700 a month instead of the $2,000, you still need to be able to make that $2,700 a month payment. If you can't make that payment, you're going to lose the house. Bankruptcy won't help you. You might be able to negotiate with the bank to get a better rate. Currently, people aren't having a ton of success with that. As foreclosures continue, that may change over time. But, you know, your bankruptcy is not going to be able to help you. If, however, your situation is one of those, for instance, your rate didn't adjust up, or it did and it didn't really bother you, and you're cruising along happily making your payments, you've got some credit card debt, you've got a house that you're paying on, and you find yourself out of a job, you get laid off, fired, or or whatever, or you quit. And you are without a job for 4 months. And now that you don't have a job, you can't make those mortgage payments. So you're paying your for the necessities of life. But the mortgage is now being neglected for 3-4 months. You're getting foreclosure notices now. The bank has tried collecting and has decided, nope, foreclosure is the right way to go. You have a notice of default, and you're marching down the path. You now get a job, and you can afford your $2,700 a month payment now. You've got the money for it. You call the bank up. You say, I want to get back on a payment plan. And the bank says, fine, we'll get you on a payment plan. You're going to pay us $2,700 a month, plus we have 3 months at $2,700 a month that you didn't pay us, so you need to make those up. And some banks will make you make those up in a very short period of time. Some banks will stick it on the end. But a lot of times, you have to pay, usually, in fact, you have to pay more than the $2,700 a month. So you find yourself where you can pay $2,700, but you can't pay $3,800 because they want an extra $1,100 a month to catch up.
So let me just summarize what I think I've heard. You're saying that if somebody falls behind on a mortgage because of losing a job, let's say, and they miss a number of payments, now they can continue making their regular payment again, but the bank is going to want them to bring their loan current. And so they may end up having $10,000 or $15,000 in past payments that the bank is asking them for. Is that the scenario that you're talking
right.
about?
Okay. Over a relatively short period of time, often 6 months or so.
Sometimes does the bank give somebody what do they call that if the bank gives you a period of time to make those payments up?
The banks have various terms. But, yeah, I mean, there'll be a forbearance or something along those lines where the bank will allow them to restructure those payments.
Mm-hmm.
However, in those circumstances where the person comes to me and says, the bank's not allowing me to go back to their original payment plan, and I can afford that, but I can't afford this huge overpayment, so I'm going to lose my house. In that instance, a Chapter 13 bankruptcy can often save them. Because what that will do is it will stop the foreclosure process as soon as it's filed, and the individual can get back onto a $2,700 a month payment, and the arrearages, the amount of money that was not paid during the period of time that they were unable to make their mortgage payment, that $10,000 or $15,000 or whatever, that money can be spread out over the life of the plan. It can be spread out over as many as 60 months. So instead of paying $10,000 over 6 months or 10 months, they're going to pay that $10,000 over 60 months. And often they're able to make that payment.
Okay. So in that situation, for someone who can't make their payments temporarily, gets behind, the bank won't let them bring their situation up current in a way that they can handle financially. That's something where a bankruptcy might help them because it gives them up to five years to spread out those late payments and make them up to the bank?
Correct. Correct.
But what about somebody that just flat out has trouble making their payments? And I'm sure you get those kinds of calls mm-hmm. from people. You know, I've heard some people have said bankruptcy helps avoid foreclosure or helps them forestall things, but it doesn't sound like that necessarily is true.
Well, bankruptcy can buy you time. But if somebody comes to me and says, hey, I want to live in my house for another couple of months, can you file bankruptcy for me to stop the process, I'll tell them no. There's not really a valid bankruptcy purpose for that, and that's not what bankruptcy is for. If they're unable to make the house payments, you can't keep the property that those payments are secured on. And that's the same for a house, it's the same for a car, it's the same for any kind of property, personal or real, that an individual has a secured payment on. In bankruptcy, you need to either surrender that property or continue to pay for it.
So the it's really not a good idea, really, to file bankruptcy because you can't make your house payment, is what I hear you saying in most cases.
In many cases. There are often reasons for individuals who have found themselves in a position where they can no longer make their house payments. There are often accompanying circumstances that make a bankruptcy practical. It's just not useful for the particular, use of stopping the foreclosure and saving the house. it may still be very practical because they were essentially scrimping and saving and sinking by a couple of $1,000s every month on a family budget for the last 2 years, and they've got $30,000 of credit card bills on top of that. And so it may make sense that if you're going to lose your home, let's go ahead and clean everything up and get you back on your feet so that you're climbing again out the other end. And so people who are in the financial crunch may still need the bankruptcy, but it's not going to necessarily save their home.
Now, what would be the step somebody could make if they wanted to avoid bankruptcy and they still had reasonably okay credit, but they were finding it just too much of a struggle every month to make all their payments? Are there strategies that, you know, again, would keep people from having to go to a bankruptcy lawyer that you would suggest they consider?
Well, there's a lot of different options for people, but in the end, it comes down to some fairly simple math. You have to take a look at your income, your net income after all of your paycheck deductions have been taken out of it and taxes have taken out. How much money is coming into the family, and where is that money going every month? And it's just basic, you know, adding and subtracting. And if you make less money than the obligations you have, you're going to start shedding some of those obligations. You have to, or you'll continue sinking financially. And for many people, the biggest problem these days is that they have a house that they can no longer afford because the house adjusted up. And in that instance, and I have to counsel people that come into my office fairly often, it makes the most financial sense for them to walk away from the home that has no equity in it, because it's gone down in value and they had 100% loan, or has almost no equity in it, and whose payments they can't afford to make, especially in a market where it's unlikely that the house is going to climb significantly in value in the next 6 months, 6 to 12 months.
So how does somebody
walk away?
How does somebody do that? I mean, how do you walk away from a house, and what are the, you know, what about them going after you for anything? How does that work?
Well, you can walk away from the house simply by not paying on the mortgage. Mm-hmm. Then what will happen is a foreclosure. And the exact effects of the foreclosure and the accompanying, you know, deficiency or otherwise, and the accompanying tax ramifications differ from state to state, and they differ depending on the individual's financial situation. In California, we have anti-deficiency statutes, which say that if an individual has a purchase money loan on a residential property that they live in, and they are foreclosed on, then there will be no deficiency judgment. A deficiency is where, let's do a simple example. You bought the house, and California houses are very expensive. A starter house is in the $500,000 these days. You buy a $500,000 house, 100% financing, interest-only loan. You can barely make those payments, but you can. Now it adjusts up because it was a 2-year interest-only loan, or 2-year fixed. The interest was only fixed for 2 years. So now you're still doing interest-only, but now the interest is much more. And the property is now worth $400,000. So what you would want to do if the property hadn't dropped in value is sell the home to get out so you don't have a problem. But you can't sell the home because you won't get enough money out of the home to pay for the $500,000 mortgage. You'd only get $400,000 in the sale, and you'd have $500,000 to pay off with that. So what are you going to do? Well, in a foreclosure, what would happen is they will sell the home at auction, or if it doesn't sell at auction, the bank will take it back and do a credit bid on it. And any deficiency between what they get out of the property and what their total loan is, basically is just written off.
I see.
The bank will then 1099 you, meaning that they'll send you they'll inform the tax, the IRS, that you have debt forgiveness income to the tune of about $100,000 in this instance. But that's not really a problem in most cases because of Section 108 of the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code, that says that an individual who receives debt forgiveness income while they are insolvent or in bankruptcy doesn't count as taxable income.
So let me just back up a second. We've got somebody that had to walk away from their house, and I know people think, oh, they could sue me if the mortgage company could sue me if there's a deficiency, if the house goes to auction and the bid isn't high enough to pay off my mortgage, they could sue me for the difference. But you're saying that in general, in most cases, at least in California, that isn't going to happen.
Right. It first of all, in many cases, it can't happen. Because of the anti-deficiency statutes. And even in those instances where it can happen because the anti-deficiency statutes don't protect you, and a very common example is when it wasn't a purchase money loan but was rather a refinance. Purchase money just means that the loan was taken at the purchase of the property, for the purchase of the property. If the loan was taken to refinance a purchase, it's not a purchase money loan anymore. And then that kills the anti-deficiency statutes. However, you still, in California, at least, and check your local state laws, would need to get you'd need to have what's called a judicial foreclosure instead of a non-judicial foreclosure in order to get a deficiency judgment. And in practice, most lending institutions don't go after that deficiency judgment. It takes a lot more time to do a judicial foreclosure, and during that time, they're losing money because they have this property that they can't move, and it costs a lot more money to do it than a non-judicial foreclosure for the bank. And the benefit that they would get out the other end would be a deficiency judgment against an individual who is probably, when faced with a $100,000 judgment, going to simply declare bankruptcy and wipe that judgment out. So in practice, banks will do this when they believe that the individual will be able to pay that judgment, which often happens in the cases of people who are heavy real estate investors or just wealthy and for some other reason. If you have $500,000 in the bank and you're not paying on your house, probably you're not paying on your house just because you decided for investment reasons that you're not going to, that the house's value is too low for the amount of loans on it and you're just walking away. And in that case, they may get the deficiency judgment if they're allowed to against you because they know they can collect it. They know you're not going to just declare bankruptcy.
For the normal person, however, they can walk away for most cases without facing the deficiency judgment, at least in California and many other states, but although they would have to check with their in their state. But the other thing that you said was, and this is what I understand, that if you have a debt that's forgiven, if you get a loan on your house to buy your house or to refinance, and then the you walk away from it, there's a percentage of the loan that is forgiven or that's wiped out, that is considered income. So the lender will send you a 1099 and they'll send a copy to the IRS saying this is what you got in the form of income. And then, and I know that some people are very much afraid of that because, of course, the IRS has such unlimited power in this country. But you're saying that the tax code actually favors people in that situation, provided they were insolvent at the time that the loan foreclosure, the loan forgiveness happened?
Yes. And a key when talking about insolvency is that they will include the house and the debt on the house in your asset and liability pool. For quick definition, for those who aren't entirely clear on what insolvency is, it's not well defined, so I'm going to take a broad sweep at it, and you'll need to talk, I'm putting all these caveats in here, to a competent CPA or a tax attorney, preferably. But insolvent generally means you have more liabilities than you have assets, so you owe more money than you have in property. And if you're about to get a $100,000 deficiency judgment because your house has gone down so much, well, on your liability side, you have a $500,000 loan, and on your asset side, you merely have a $400,000 house. All of the other pieces of property that you have aren't really going to modify that $100,000, that your asset side a whole lot. It's all used property, and it's really not worth a whole lot. So maybe you have $420,000 total of property. If you own cars, that goes up by a tiny bit. But frankly, if you own a high value car, many individuals have loans on that. And so you got to stick those loans on the liability side. So most people in these circumstances are insolvent simply because they owe this extra $100,000 debt, on their shoulders, and that makes them insolvent. So when that debt gets wiped out, it's not taxable income. And so you don't need to worry about that. Collectors for banks, in an attempt to get you to pay for your mortgage, to get one or two more payments out of you, we'll explain to you that you're going to get this 1099 and we'll try to frighten you into this problem. But you're going to want to check this with somebody who doesn't have an interest in making you pay your loan.
That could be just super good news for somebody that's sweating it out, getting this enormous 1099, kind of being kicked when they're down. I mean, that could
right.
be fantastic news. Now, I have a question. If someone has already filed bankruptcy, when can they file again?
The law is about 8 years from the last discharge. And it depends a little bit on it's not really when can you file again, it's when can you get another discharge. You know, you could do a 13 2 years after you've received a discharge for a 7. You just won't get a discharge out the other end of the 13, but you can still get the protections of the bankruptcy system. But it's the rough answer is many years. The other hesitation I have in giving a precise number is that the bankruptcy code has recently changed, in the last year and a half, and is likely to change again. And every time it changes, numbers change within the code. And so I would hate for somebody to be listening to this 3 years from now and decide that what I'm giving them is the right thing, even though the code just changed. But once you've received a bankruptcy discharge, meaning your debts are wiped out as a result of bankruptcy, you're not going to be able to receive another discharge for many years.
Now, there's two types of bankruptcy, a 13 and a 7, that apply to most people. And is this true of both a 13 and a 7?
It's true for receiving a discharge, so yes.
So when
you can still file a 13, for instance, and not get a discharge, however. And that would happen if you do a 100% plan. So if you, in our instance of the individual filing a 13 in order to pay back the arrearages on his house, as long as they are able to cure those arrearages and have the rest of their debts paid off by the end of that five-year period, there won't need to be a discharge anyway. It's just spread out the payments over those 5 years. If they make all of those payments, you know, maybe in 4.5 years, they're done with all of their payments. There's no discharge. And so that's not a problem. They can still use the bankruptcy system to shelter themselves and to get themselves back on their feet. They just can't get a discharge of debts.
So in a Chapter 13, the debts that someone has, the unsecured debts, are they're allowed 5 years to pay them, and they may have to pay all of them, or you're saying they may only have to pay a percentage of them?
Certain types of debts need to be paid in full. Others don't. For instance, in a Chapter 13 plan, your arrearages on a secured piece of property need to be paid in full. So if you're behind by $20,000 on your house, you need to go ahead and stick that out over 60 months, potentially with interest during that period of time, and pay it off in full. However, your credit cards don't need to be paid in full in the plan. So the amount of your payment in a Chapter 13 plan is dependent on the amount of your disposable income, which is a measure of, your gross income minus your expenses. And if you have a large disposable income, you're going to end up with a large Chapter 13 payment. And if that payment multiplied over a 60-month plan is sufficient to pay off all of your debts, you have no discharge. If that disposable income multiplied out over 60 months is enough merely to pay off those debts required to be paid off in a Chapter 13 plan, the debts that aren't required to be paid off, for instance, your general unsecureds, like credit cards, many personal judgments, those kinds of things, they don't need to be paid in full. And, maybe they'll get 10 cents on the dollar, and then there'll be a discharge of those debts.
I see. So it's getting that discharge of debts, which you can only get roughly every 8 years.
Right.
And back to somebody who's owing on their credit cards and their mortgage. Now, we've established that if they want to stay in their house, they're really going to have to keep paying on their mortgage in general. Can the threat of bankruptcy, without having to file, can that help somebody in your experience?
No. That's the quick answer, the quick and dirty. When you're dealing with a bank, and that's typically who you're dealing with when you're talking about mortgages, if you call the bank and tell them, I'm not making my payments, I'm going to declare bankruptcy, the bank doesn't care. That doesn't affect them, really. It's not going to affect their ability to collect on the security. It's going to slow them down a little bit, perhaps. But they're not going to negotiate any better with you or any worse. Individuals who are, who may be in a circumstance where bankruptcy is appropriate, then that's a useful stance to take if you're being threatened by a collection agent who says, we're going to get this massive deficiency judgment. You don't want that, do you? Well, then you can tell them, well, I'll just file bankruptcy and it'll wipe that out. And that will shut them up. But it's not useful for actually renegotiating the loan with the bank. The bank's going to have its own policies on that. And they may require you, as part of a workout plan with them, they may require that you demonstrate financial hardship, in which case you'll have a packet of financial information that's very similar to what you'd need to do in a bankruptcy, and give that to them so that they can look through that and decide, yes, this is an individual who will be able to make a payment of approximately this size, and we are going to set up a loan that fits that. But threatening bankruptcy isn't a very big motivator, negative motivator for most large lending institutions, at least secured lending institutions.
And now, if someone does have to file bankruptcy, how does that affect their foreclosure process and their loan, the mortgage loans that they have?
If they need to file bankruptcy, as soon as you file the bankruptcy, what's called the automatic stay kicks into place. That's the bankruptcy court basically says to all creditors, including your secured creditors, thou shalt not collect anymore. so they can no longer do any form of collections efforts. They're not going to continue the foreclosure. They're not going to, they're not going to sell your house if it's the day before if you file bankruptcy on Monday and the foreclosure sale is supposed to happen on Tuesday, the foreclosure sale will not happen on Tuesday. You need to tell them about it, of course, Monday afternoon, but the sale won't go through. It will stop all of that. It'll grind it all to a halt. So that's the effect of filing the bankruptcy.
That sounds good.
It does. However, if you're unable to make the payments on the house, what's going to happen within a couple of months is that the bank will file what's called a relief from the automatic stay, which is a filing by a creditor that allows them to go after the security for their loan, which would, in the case of a mortgage, would be your house, without the automatic stay stopping them. And they'll be able to get that if you're not making your payments on it, generally. And especially if the only reason for filing was to stop them from foreclosing and you're not actually paying for the loan.
So if you do file bankruptcy and you are just overwhelmed with your payments, if you keep making your house payment, it doesn't really affect your mortgage at all.
Correct. Yes, that's absolutely true. So if you, and this happens all the time, I get people who are just fine with their houses. Everything's working along, but they've lost a job. One of the spouses has lost a job. The other's job is capable of covering the house and the baseline expenses. But now they can't afford the lifestyle they had, and they have, $100,000 in credit card debt, or even $20,000, $25,000 in credit card debt, and they need to wipe that out. In that case, yeah, you can do a bankruptcy. You do a bankruptcy, and as long as you keep paying on your house, you should be able to keep your house.
Mm-hmm. And it just happens to slow down. Now, what if you're negotiating with the bank at that point? Does it kind of mess them up?
It would depend a lot on the bank. They're not supposed to continue collections efforts. Whether or not they feel that renegotiating the loan is more like an affirmation process, a reaffirmation process, then that's not going to stop them. If they're really just trying to collect on you, then they're not supposed to do that. So really you would want to have your attorney involved in that process. Your bankruptcy attorney should be able to give you some particular guidance on that. It's going to depend on what kind of negotiating you're doing with the bank. If it's just negotiating paying off the debt, maybe not. But if it's reaffirming the loan or basically saying, I still owe this despite the bankruptcy, well, that's perfectly allowed despite the automatic stay.
And how do you find people's biggest mistake that they're making when in terms of bankruptcy? What do you see that the biggest mistake as being?
Well, that's a pretty broad question. I mean, I think that the primary error that I hear, it's more myths. People have a big misunderstanding of exactly how bankruptcy works, what it can do for them, and the penalties associated with bankruptcy. Many people think of bankruptcy as a four-letter word. They think of people who have filed bankruptcy as bad people, and they don't want to be one of them. You know, they think of these are financially irresponsible slobs who people like me would never be like. They also have misconceptions given to them often by well-intentioned friends about how the bankruptcy system works, and they think it can't work for them, for whatever reason. Especially these days when the law has just changed, there's a lot of attorneys out there who used to file Chapter 7s and were scared away because the new law has changed fairly dramatically on who can qualify, how that qualification looks, what the effects of the bankruptcy are, what all the rules are, the different procedural aspects of it. And those attorneys are basically misinformed on exactly how the case works, or how a bankruptcy works. So a lot of what I do when people call me is explain to them exactly how bankruptcy works, exactly what the penalties are associated with it are, and whether or not their circumstance is one that bankruptcy can help them with.
Mm-hmm. How does it affect someone's other, I've heard, like, for example, student loans. How does it affect student loans?
Yeah, it doesn't affect student loans, period. If you owe, the new bankruptcy law has tightened up an already fairly tight set of rules regarding student loans. At this point, private or otherwise, if you owe money on a student loan, you're pretty much not going to be able to discharge them. There are some very, very limited exceptions for significant hardship and things like that, but for the vast, vast majority of people, student loans are not going to be affected by bankruptcy. So if the reason somebody is considering bankruptcy is because they owe, I have a lot of compatriots from law school who came out of law school with $120,000 of debt, and those individuals are going to owe that money. There's no bankrupting your way out of it at this point.
Okay, so if people can't make all their payments and they had to file bankruptcy, they're still going to have to pay the same payments on their student loan generally?
Well, the nice thing about student loans is that they're often fairly good at working with you about making the payments small. They view these things as long-term loans often. So you can usually work out something with a student loan company. However, they're a lot less likely to reduce the total amount of student loans that you owe. They'll be a lot more likely to just give you some more time to pay them or reduce your payments in the interim while you're going through your financial difficulties.
And when somebody goes through bankruptcy, I've heard of people getting literally out of the bankruptcy court. They get their petition for discharge issued by the court, and now it's done with that. And I hear that they get home, and in their mailbox are all these credit card offers. And does that really happen?
It does, actually. The credit industry, especially the credit card industry, makes its money in large part by transactions at the register. They are very happy to have you using their card to buy your basic necessities and extend you a few hundred dollars in credit. And that's actually a good thing for an individual who's just come out of bankruptcy, because it can help them reestablish credit by paying off that balance in full. But keep in mind that right before a bankruptcy, your credit often looks much worse than it does right after a bankruptcy, even though you filed the bankruptcy. And this is one of the largest myths or misconceptions about bankruptcy that I encounter in initial phone calls with clients, is that they say, well, I'll never have credit again, or my credit will be destroyed, or they say, how long will the bankruptcy remain on my credit? And when I say 10 years, they freak out and say, I'll never be able to borrow money again for the next decade. And that's not true. The decision that a bank makes regarding whether or not to loan you money is based on the raw data that they get from your credit report. But which parts of the data and they're looking at, and which and the amount of weight that they apply to each of those data points it varies depending on the bank, the size of the loan they're making, whether it's secured or not, and basically the bank's internal policies. So you'll get individuals who can buy a home within a year and a half of filing for a bankruptcy, as long as everything else looks okay. You get credit card offers promptly. If you think about it from a small lender's perspective, somebody who's thinking about lending you, say, $5,000, before the bankruptcy, you had $40,000 credit card debt. You had a bunch of lates because before filing, you're often not paying on your cards. Your credit's pretty crappy. And after filing the bankruptcy, you've got zero credit card debt. And you're starting to build positive credit again by paying off a credit card in full. Additionally, and there's one very important fact in there, before filing the bankruptcy, someone thinking about giving you another $5,000 loan must be aware that you're in danger, that their loan may be discharged in a pending bankruptcy. After filing the bankruptcy, the individual who's just filed can't get a discharge again for a large number of years, which means that as a lender thinking of loaning you $5,000, I'm going to be thinking, well, even if they can't pay me, I'm going to be able to chase them down for the next X number of years, and they can't just file for bankruptcy. So it's actually a fairly, and I'll be first, you know, I'm the first $5,000 out there. They don't have $40,000 of other debts. So you're actually a slightly better risk at that point than you are before you go into bankruptcy.
Should somebody who's thinking about filing bankruptcy, should they make sure that they keep one good credit card, one company happy? Does that make any sense?
Some people get very emotionally attached to a particular credit card. I usually try to talk them out of it. There's not really a whole lot of incentive, in my personal opinion, for people to keep any credit cards. I had an individual who was here just yesterday who was explaining to me that he really wanted to keep the following cards, mm-hmm. and he laid five cards out in front of me. And it was like $15,000 of debt on those five cards. He had about $120,000 of secured or unsecured debt, so there was a lot. But still, he was looking to keep about 10% of his debts, and I asked him why. And he says, well, because we want to be able to have credit, we want to be able to, and because we feel like we... You know, and he kind of hemmed and hawed a little bit, and he didn't have a real good, solid answer. And I explained to him, well, look, the purpose of the bankruptcy here is to wipe the slate clean. There's not any more penalty associated with discharging all of your debt rather than just most of it. You may as well wipe it all out and start over. And you'll be able to get a credit card in the near future, the very near future. That's not really a problem.
That's very surprising.
You may not be able to get one with a $20,000 credit limit. But you'll be able to get one and make your payments.
Mm-hmm. That's very surprising to me. That really is. But like, if somebody has a credit card that they haven't used, would it make sense for them to keep it current, and then they'd still be able to use it with the same credit limit after the bankruptcy, or do they automatically cancel the card?
It depends on the bank. For instance, credit unions often will just cancel it. They'll be done with it. But some of them will allow you to reaffirm it or to keep the card open after the bankruptcy as long as you don't wipe out any of their debts. And some banks will allow you to keep it open even if you're wiping out a different card under the same bank. It all depends on the bank, and you're going to need to talk to both your bankruptcy attorney and the bank itself that you're talking about. The one thing you need to be careful about is expecting that if you pay off a particular debt, that they will allow you to keep the card open, because that's not always true. They have the right to not issue you a card. And if you decide to keep a $2,000 credit card that has $1,500 on it, and you reaffirm the debt and you promise to pay it off, and you do pay it off, there's no reason that they're not going to cancel that at some point in the future. There's no guarantees.
Do you find that people oftentimes don't consider the bankruptcy option soon enough? That's a mistake that is commonly made?
Yes. And that the worst thing that I see is when people don't talk to a bankruptcy attorney early enough and they find out later on that I could have protected assets that I can't because they're gone. For instance, somebody with $30,000 of credit card debt and, you know, $20,000 in their 401k and who's 50 years old, will, if they come to me before they've done anything, then I'll tell them, look, I can protect your whole 401k. It's all exempt. They're not going to take that away in the bankruptcy. And I can wipe out the $30,000. Then I can wipe out their 30K, their plus 30K essentially at the other end. If instead they panic, they think bankruptcy is the last thing in the world that I want to do. I'm going to try to pay this off, and they empty their 401k and they take the $20,000. They get maybe $15,000 out of it. After penalties and everything, and then they put that 15 onto their cards, and now they've only got 15K of debt, but it turns out that 6 months later, they're back to $20,000 of debt because their lifestyle was just, you know, unbalanced, and they're slightly negative, maybe because they're paying too much on a mortgage. Now they come talk to me because now they've hit rock bottom. And I ask people every time I talk to them, do you have a 401k? Do you have any retirement plans? And a lot of times they tell me, I used to. And I used to means I took it out in the last year and tried to bail myself out with that money because I felt like and that was the wrong decision. I could have protected that money. You would still have that money and we'd be clean. So understanding your options is critical.
And I suppose
and understanding the powers of the bankruptcy system is critical.
And I suppose they're not going to keep good credit anyway at that point. I mean, at that point, it's not going to get any worse credit-wise, is it?
Right. I mean, your credit doesn't change whether or not you've wiped out the debts, whether or not you've wiped out 30K of debts or 15K of debts, and whether or not you've wiped out, whether or not you did it while you had a 401K sitting around. So it's, you know, you're going to have the same penalty. You may as well keep your retirement. Your retirement is critical.
Whose credit is better in the end of this? Is it better for someone that's filed bankruptcy, or is it better for someone that's just delinquent and late and charge-offs all over the place that hasn't filed bankruptcy?
I wish I had an easy answer to that. That's an exceptionally complicated answer, or complicated question, which would require a very complicated answer. In fact, I'm not even going to take a stab.
It's not even clear. So it's not clear that somebody's better off with poor credit or with a bankruptcy. It's not that clear.
Right. Really, the decision on the bankruptcy, a lot of people make it thinking about their credit. What's going to happen to my credit?
Right.
That's actually not that the decision to file bankruptcy shouldn't be hinging on that. It should be hinging on your financial health and what you look like pre-bankruptcy and what you would look like post-bankruptcy. And if it makes substantial sense to file bankruptcy for your financial health, then, you know, even if you take a credit hit, then, you know, you can climb back out of that much more easily than you can a huge financial hole from a negative cash flow.
So if someone's decided that they cannot afford their house anymore and the bankruptcy is not an option because, I mean, it may be an option, but it's not going to help them with their house. And they've just decided they're going to have to walk away because they owe more than it's worth. Should they actually stop making payments to the bank and just sort of put that into an account and use that for a down payment or a rent on a new place?
Often that's the best thing for them to do. The foreclosure process takes a long period of time. And during that time, you still own the home and you still have the right to stay there. If you need to stay in the home to keep a roof over your head, then you can take the money that otherwise would have gone toward the mortgage, or since you don't have the full amount for the mortgage, some percentage of that, and stick it in a bank account and start building up a small buffer so that when you move out of the house prior to the foreclosure, you'll have money available to do a larger deposit for a place to rent because your credit will have a whole bunch of missed payments on it, and so your credit won't be ideal. But oftentimes you can still get a place to rent despite that, if you have a larger down payment, a larger deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get that deposit essentially by not paying on the house and living there for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm. So obviously we would never advise someone not to pay their bills, but that's a common strategy that people pursue that's sometimes in their best interest, it sounds like.
Right.
And now, once the foreclosure process is complete, if someone's still in their house, and it goes to a trustee sale and someone else owns the house, either the lender or a party who's bid for the house, what happens next? Because they're still in the house.
Right. The next thing that happens in California, it's called an unlawful detainer, and it may have different terms in other states, but it's basically a state action for eviction. The former homeowner and now tenant, is going to be evicted from the home. And the real problem with somebody who's been hanging out in the house for the last couple of months, you know, and not paying on their rent, the last 6 or 7 months often, with waiting until they're actually evicted, is now at that point they have an eviction on their record, and it's very difficult to find a home, to find a place to rent because of the eviction. If you're going to be hanging out in your home, trying to just get your act together so that you can afford a place to rent, you need to move out in the last, you know, in the notice of sale period, the last 30 days or so before the foreclosure, you want to go ahead and move out of the property. That way you don't ever get the eviction on your record, and that helps you from a ability to rent perspective.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. And you're saying that even if you have, at that point, you're going to have poor credit, but if you don't have an eviction on your legal record, that's going to make it much easier to rent, even with poor credit.
Generally, that's true, yes.
Do they check whether you've had an eviction before you rent a place?
It depends on who you're renting it from. And this is another tip that I give people who are moving out of an owned home and going back into the rental market. You can rent from apartment complexes, or you can rent from a guy who has a piece of investment property. And the gentleman with the investment property, often they have sort of random almost requirements for your credit. They'll pull your credit most of the time, but when they do, a lot of times they'll make the decisions to whether or not to rent to you based on whether they think you're a nice person or not. An apartment complex doesn't really care whether you're a nice person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a criminal background and are clearly not a nice person, well, that's a problem. But what they're really looking for is, they have a formula, they have a procedure, they're going to look at your credit, and if you meet certain requirements, they'll let you in, and if you don't, they won't.
Mm-hmm.
And their requirements typically are more stringent. So I've found people who have damaged credit, plus an eviction on their record, have an exceptionally difficult time renting from an apartment complex, but don't necessarily have much of a challenge renting from individuals. So, you know, you just need to start hunting for a place to rent that is rented by an individual. And, you know, you can look at things like you can look online or look in the classified ads in the back of the local paper, that kind of thing. If you look at the real estate guides that are often, you know, these bound, color printed, find an apartment brochures that are in the front of your grocery store or drugstore. There's paid advertisers in those, and so they're usually apartment complexes. So if you go through all of those, you're going to pretty much only find apartment complexes.
God, you know, what I love talking with you, what I love about it, Jason, is that you really have some great information and you're not judgmental. It just never sounds like you're judging me if I run into hard times that, I shouldn't. It's just part of life.
Yeah, and there's a lot of reasons. Very few people, when I talk to people about the bankruptcy profession, they think, oh, you must be dealing with all kinds of bad people. And no, that's not at all true. I very rarely find bad people. When I do, I show them the door. Most of the individuals who are coming to me and find themselves in financial hardship are there through no fault of their own. They're there because something has happened to them. Or they lost a job, they were injured, there was, you know, the housing market changed. There's just something like that has happened, and they were unable to pull themselves out of it without the help of the court system. And this is why I like bankruptcy. The purpose of bankruptcy is to give people a fresh start. It's the whole reason we have bankruptcy. It's in the core of our Constitution. It's not even in those silly amendments like the freedom of speech and right to religion and all that kind of stuff. It's more fundamental than that. We've had it since before America was around. We carried it over from our British history. When we got rid of debtors' prison, we had to do something that keeps people from essentially becoming servants of the lending institution,
uh-huh.
Which is the alternative.
I see. Well, that's interesting. That's a very interesting history. I really appreciate your time so very much. Could you just give your website and your phone number once again in case people haven't copied it down the first time?
Sure. If you have any questions, you can give me a call at area code 858-793-9800, and I'd be happy to chat with you. Otherwise, you can look us up on our website and email us from there at www.avatarlegal.com. Avatar is spelled A, V as in Victor, A, T as in Tom, A, R as in Roger.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much.
Sure thing.